Lecture 36, Dynasty 21, Egypt Divided.
Welcome back. Remember last time we took a little bit of a side detour from our chronological history of Egypt, and we talked about ancient Egyptian magic. I'd like to go back two lessons before. And if you'll remember, we were talking about the 20th dynasty. And at the end of that dynasty, something absolutely outrageous for Egyptian history occurred. The high priest of Amun at Thebes, a man named Herihor, wrote his name in a cartouche, indicating that he was king of Egypt. Not only that, he built his own temple at Karnak Temple, dedicated to Khonsu, the son of Amun and Mut. So he's building his own temple. And on the walls of those temples that he put up, on those walls, he is shown the same size as the king of Egypt, who is ruling in the north. So in a sense, he's claiming, I'm king of Egypt also. There are two people claiming to be king of Egypt. One is Ramses the 11th in the north, and the other is our man, Herihor. It's outrageous. Now, how does this happen? Well, the dynasty we're going to look at today, the 21st dynasty, is unique. It's, in a sense, a tale of two cities. We have two simultaneous dynasties ruling, one from the north, one from the south. We have the descendants of Herihor, this high priest, calling themselves kings, ruling from Thebes. And in the north, we have a totally separate dynasty, also calling themselves kings. That's why I say it's a tale of two cities. Now, many Egyptologists might think, and do think, that what we've got really is warring factions. We've got kind of the Hatfields and the McCoys slugging it out over who is king of Egypt. I'm king, you're king, you know, that kind of thing. No, I don't think so. I think, really, we have a kind of peaceful coexistence. I want you to bear with me and try to play detective a little bit. What I'd like you to do is, as I describe what happens during this dynasty, actually two dynasties, one in the north, one in the south, I'd like you to look for signs that there's really a peaceful coexistence. Let's try it. I'm going to start first with the priest kings of the south. These people are all high priests of Amun, and they are ruling from Thebes. And let's talk about what they do and what their reign is like. Now, as I mentioned, the one who starts this whole thing is Herihor, the high priest who builds his little temples there and puts himself as large as the king, puts his name in a cartouche. Well, he dies before Ramses the 11th, who is ruling in the north. He's succeeded by another high priest of Amun, Pianch. And Pianch dies about the same time as Ramses XI, just about. But the important thing is, in the south, in Thebes, we have a pattern established. The high priest will take over and call himself king. Now, the next high priest who rules in Thebes is Pinagem, and he's important. He does things. Now, first, how does he become high priest? Well, that's hereditary. You didn't have to have a special religious calling to be a priest. You just had to say the right words, do the deeds. So he can do that easily enough. But how does he become king? Well, if you'll remember, there's a theory that you became pharaoh by marrying the right woman, the heiress theory, that there is a woman who carries in her royal blood the right to be king. So whom does he marry? He marries the daughter of Ramses XI, the king who had ruled in the north. Now, it sounds to me as if these are not warring factions. But Pinagem does other things than that's just marrying a daughter. He inspected the Valley of the Kings. Now, he's high priest. One of his jobs is to make sure that the religion remains intact. And he has an inspection of the Valley of the Kings in which he discovers the tombs of the pharaohs have been plundered. Now remember, he's trying to be a king himself, so he is going to view these people as pharaohs and his ancestors, both. He wants these are my people. He restores the mummies. He has some of them rewrapped. and he labels them, right? So he's trying to carry out what a pharaoh should do. Now, he dates his reign in a very interesting way. And here we're going to do a little side trip. I want to explain how the Egyptians kept track of their years. Because Pinogem does something very important for us. We keep years consecutively. After the year 2000, we know what year is coming. 2001. And after that, 2002, and so on. We have a nice, long, consecutive string. The Egyptians did not do that. And that's why sometimes it's hard for us to figure out, in what year did this happen? The pharaoh was so central to the Egyptian mentality that their calendar depended on who was king. It was kind of a pharaoh-centric calendar. So, for example, when a pharaoh like Ramses the Great died, during his reign, he would have kept count of the years in his reign. First year of Ramses the Great, second year of Ramses the Great. His last year would be the 67th year of Ramses the Great. And if an event took place during that reign, he'd say, month 3, day 1 of the year of Ramses, 67. But what happened when Ramses died? Well, the next year is not year 68. No. The new king, and in this case, remember, the 13th son of Ramses became pharaoh, Merneptah? The next year is year 1 of Merneptah. So the Egyptians kept track of their days, months, years in terms of pharaoh's reigns. Now, remember, Pinogem, our high priest, has married the daughter of Ramses XI, and he's claiming he's king. He's looked in the Valley of the Kings. He's tidied it up. He's preserved the bodies. How does he keep track of his years, of his reign? He doesn't say year 1 of Pinogem, year 2 of Pinogem. No. He dates his years according to the king who is ruling in the north, somebody who's now replaced Ramses XI. This is Smendes. So he says year 1 of Smendes, year 2 of Smendes. In other words, this is a sign of deference to the kings of the north, that they're really the kings. I'm calling myself king, but I'll keep track by their years. So I think this is another sign that we really don't have a kind of warring faction. There's a peaceful coexistence. They're managing it with each other. Now, there is a kind of neat little sidebar about Pinogem's Ushabti statues. Remember last time when we talked about Egyptian magic? I mentioned that if you were wealthy enough, you wanted 365 Ushabtis, one for each day of the year. They were going to serve you in the next world. Well, Pinogem's Ushabtis, right? Pinogem's Ushabtis are the ones that started the search for that royal tomb that had been discovered by tomb robbers that led to finding all the royal mummies together. You'll remember that in the 1870s, antiquities started appearing on the market that were from a royal tomb. A royal tomb. And immediately, the antiquities service knew, a royal tomb has been found, we have to find it. Well, the whole thing that started it was Pinogem's little Ushabti statues, these bright blue things. They were being sold, and somebody knew his tomb had been found. Interestingly, by the way, you can still see these Ushabtis on the market today. They appear in the auction houses, you know, like Sotheby's and Christie's, these upscale places. And every once in a while, you see one of Pinogem's Ushabtis for sale, and you know that these were found by the tomb robbers in the 1870s, 1880s, sold on the market, and they're still knocking around. It's a bit of history. But Pinogem dies, and he's succeeded by two of his sons. Remember, the high priest is a hereditary thing. You can do it. One is not important. Masaherta, not very important. Menkheper is another high priest of Amun, right? But the pattern has been set. These guys don't reign that long, but we have high priests ruling as kings. Now, Menkheper successors are two of his sons. One, Smendes II, minor, reigns a few years. But the next, Pinogem II. Interesting things happen. Now first, he carries out another inspection of the royal necropolis, right? The Valley of the Kings. He finds that virtually all of the tombs have been robbed. But he makes a decision, kind of executive thinking. Also, it indicates the state of Egypt. He realizes the Valley of the Kings cannot be protected anymore. He's given up on the Valley of the Kings and all hope that you can put a guard there or anything like that. Things have deteriorated so much in Egypt that he's got to move the mummies. Move them. He is the one who gathers together many of these mummies, many of them, and has them moved to a secret cliff tomb at Deir al-Bahari. And he thinks that this tomb is so safe that he will choose it as his final burying place. And it is safe. It remains safe for more than 3,000 years. Right? So this is placed, his burial is found in this tomb. But he realizes it's over for Egypt. We can't protect the Valley of the Kings. And no longer will the pharaohs be buried in the Valley of the Kings. So remember, you know, not all pharaohs are buried in pyramids. That's way earlier in history of Egypt. And not all pharaohs are buried in the Valley of the Kings. Different places for different times. So anyway, Pinhajem dies, is buried in his safe tomb. And he's succeeded by a very minor king, Pausanias. Let me say something about the name Pausanias, by the way. Pausanias III he's called. Names are unfortunately not consistent in Egyptology. You might say Pausanias, you might hear Pausanias, you might hear Susanias, you might hear Pausanias. Same guy, right? We don't have a consistent transliteration for it. We should. We really should. But we don't. But with him, with this minor pharaoh, it's the end. It's the end of these high priests ruling out of Thebes. Now, remember, while they're ruling, we have the kings in the north, who are also kings of Egypt, probably the official kings. And let's talk about that consecutive sort of that dynasty that's running along also. Now, first, remember we had Ramses XI. Well, Ramses XI dies, as we know. Smendes takes over. Who's Smendes? We don't really know. He declares himself king. If I had a bet, I'd say the reason he can declare himself king is military. He's a military man. Remember back to the time of Tutankhamun, for example, when there were turbulent times, and after Tutankhamun we had a vizier ruling, Ai, for a little while. But then, there's no children, there's no clear successor. Who takes over? Horemheb, the general. Almost always, in hard times, the military takes over. I mean, it's the same in South America. That happens today. So, probably, if I had a bet, a military man who declares himself king. Now, what does he do? First, he moves the capital. He moves the capital from that biblical city that Ramses created, P. Ramesses, to another site in the delta, this marshy area almost, Tanis. Now, he causes a problem for archaeologists with this move. When he moves, he takes with him the large statues of Ramses the Great that Ramses had built for this biblical city. He takes with him the obelisks. They're small obelisks, but they're obelisks that Ramses had erected there. And he brings them to his new capital because he wants to show we're grand, but he may not be able to build everything so quickly. So these are kind of like ready-made, prefabricated city. You know, you take an obelisk, you take a statue, and you got it. Now the problem is, later archaeologists, when they excavated at the new site, Tanis, they found all these statues of Ramses. And they figured, this is the biblical city of Ramses. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable to think you find all these statues of Ramses. Ramses put them here. But no, they were moved, right? But he moves the capital. Anyway, when he dies, he is followed by a pharaoh, Amenemnisu. The name isn't important. What's really important is, whose son is he? Herihor. Remember that name? That was the high priest of Thebes who started it all in the south by writing his name in a cartouche. So we've got a son of Herihor now sort of being shuffled north to become king, right? To become king. And I think this shows that Thebes in the south and this new Tanis dynasty in the north are cooperating. They're sort of shifting people. Now, he is followed by Pausanias the First. Right? Also, Susanias I, right? Any way you want to say it. I will tell you something that's going to tantalize you. I promise I will give you the full details in the next lecture. But let me say this. The tomb of this king, Pausanias the First, was found intact. It rivaled Tutankhamun's. I will explain why you don't know about it next time, I promise. But let me tell you something about the burial, just the burial of him. I'll give you the details of the discovery of the tomb later. Let me say what he was buried in, first of all. He's buried at Tanis, right? His new capital. He was buried in a pink Aswan granite, right? Big pink Aswan granite sarcophagus. The lid to that sarcophagus was Merneptah's. Merneptah, the 13th son who became king, right? 13th son of Ramses the Great, who became king. It's kind of curious. Now think about this. Merneptah was buried in the Valley of the Kings. What is this Tanis king, coming later, doing with Merneptah's lid to his sarcophagus? Right? Now, I'll complete the description of his burial, and then I'll tell you how I think he got it, how he got that lid. Inside that sarcophagus with Merneptah's lid was another stone sarcophagus, black granite. Inside that was another alabaster one. Inside that was a solid silver coffin. Solid silver. Now, let me say this. Silver, if you'll remember, was more valuable than gold in Egypt. About three times. These kings of Tanis were not poor. You know, everybody makes a big deal out of Tutankhamun's golden coffin. This is three times as valuable. Silver. And beautiful. And beautiful. Inside that silver coffin was the body of the pharaoh. Badly damaged. Tanis is a moist area. It was basically a skeleton. And even around the bones of the long bones were some aquatic plants. You know, it's kind of vines growing around. Really quite something. But the face of the pharaoh, the skull, was covered with a gold mask. Not unlike Tutankhamun, this burial. Wealthy. These people were not poor. That's the important thing. Now, I promised I'd say, how did he wind up with Merneptah's sarcophagus lid? Well, remember the Deir el-Bahari cache, that when all the mummies were brought together by the high priest and put for safety? That was not the only time that happened. Not the only time that royal mummies came together to be moved. There was another time. And this was another discovery of royal mummies. And let me tell you about this. The excavator was Victor Loret. Now, Loret was a strange man. Strange. He was made director of antiquities because the previous director resigned suddenly, Gaston Maspero, to go back to Paris. And Loret was the man who was there. He was quickly promoted, and he was a little bit above his head. He was a good archaeologist, and he decided to investigate the Valley of the Kings. This is 1898. Now, he was very impressionable, is a kind word. Some people say he was unstable. The discovery that I'm going to tell you about literally led to him having a nervous breakdown. He had a nervous breakdown. As I say, he was excavating in the Valley of the Kings. And in 1892, he found the tomb of Amenhotep II, the pharaoh, much plundered. Understand, he is unprepared for what he's going to find. It was totally unsuspected. And he enters, and it's been plundered. But what does he see? He's going by candlelight. Now remember, there's no electricity in these tombs. And they turn, and he's going by candlelight. He's got this candle. And in a side room, he finds three mummies lying on their backs. There's a mummy of an old woman, mummy of a young prince. He has a side lock of youth on his hair. And there's a young woman. Now all three have, their heads have been smashed in. There are holes in their heads. And Loret's mind is racing. He's thinking about human sacrifice. He's thinking about what has happened. I mean, what he doesn't realize is the tomb has been robbed. The robbers have used their axes to take the bandages off, smashing through the heads. But he doesn't realize this yet. And he's got a long night ahead of him. He then goes deeper into the tomb. He finds stone sarcophagus of Amenhotep II. And there, in the sarcophagus, is Amenhotep II. A plundered mummy, barely in rags, but it's a royal mummy. He continues. There's the body of a young man that's in a model boat that was supposed to take the pharaoh maybe to the next world or be used in the next world. He sees another mummy. But then, he goes to another side chamber. And the side chamber is bricked up with stones. During the time of the 21st dynasty kings. Now, takes down some of the bricks. Peers in. What does he see? Coffins. 9 of them. He removes the stones. He goes inside, climbs over some of them, has a candle, and he blows away the dust on one of them. You know? And he can read a cartouche. It says Ramses. And he's probably not sure which Ramses yet. Is it Ramses 5? Is it Ramses 6? Whatever. But it's a Ramses. It's a royal. And he wonders, is this like Deir al-Bahari? Have I found another royal cache of mummies? And he starts blowing the dust off of other mummies. And it's cartouches everywhere. He has found, indeed, another royal cache. Now, in this royal cache is Amenhotep III. Remember the great dazzling king of the sun disk, right? Amenhotep III, one of Egypt's greatest. Also in this cache is the mummy of Ramses the Great's 13th son, Meneptah, who became king of Egypt. Now, remember, I'm telling you this story to explain how a king in Tanis gets the lid of Meneptah. What I think happens is the following. When the high priests are doing these inventories of the Valley of the Kings, of course, they discover the tombs have been plundered. What do? They're moving the mummies to safe places. One place is that Deir al-Bahari cache high in the cliff. Another is the tomb of Amenhotep II. They're going to put them all, sort of, so to speak, they're going to put all their eggs in one basket. Put all the royal pharaohs in the side chamber, brick it up, and hope you can protect that one. And it worked. They stayed protected. Now, as you're bringing the pharaohs out of their original tombs, let's take Meneptah. He's buried in his huge sarcophagi. Pig has one granite. They're not going to drag that to the tomb of Amenhotep II. Everybody will see. It might be too crowded for it. It's only a small side room with 9 mummies. So they leave it. They leave the sarcophagus behind. And they bury the mummy of Meneptah. Now, you've got this really neat sarcophagus and lid. Why should it go to waste? It's shipped north to Tanis for Pausanias to be buried in. And that's how a king in Tanis comes to be buried with the lid of a pharaoh buried in the Valley of the Kings. I think it's a cooperation between the people in the south in Thebes who are overlooking, overseeing the Valley of the Kings, and the kings who are ruling in the north. But it's quite a burial, Pausanias is. But anyway, these kings were not poor. His son, Amenope, right? He was buried at Tanis also. He too had a gold face mask. A beautiful gold face mask. There are other kings of this dynasty. There's Osakan the Elder. Hardly anything's known about him. But then we get Siamun. Siamun is interesting. King of Tanis, right? King ruling out of Tanis. He builds a Tanis, a sign that he's got some money, wealth, builds a temple. To whom? Amun, the principal god of Thebes. What you're really getting, in a sense, is Tanis is mirroring the religious capital of Thebes, because the chief god in Thebes is Amun. And he's building a temple to Amun at Tanis. There seems to be a kind of almost mirror image of what's going on here. Now, there's an interesting connection here with the Bible. With the Bible. Because during Siamun's reign, we have a funny phenomenon. Now, remember, this is the period when David is fighting with the Philistines and he unites the tribes of Israel. This is a period when we start to get princesses of Egypt, marrying out. Now, let me explain what I mean by marrying out. Remember in the good old days of Ramses the Great, when things were really good? Well, Ramses married 2 Hittite princi, 2 princesses. Right? He marries 2 of them. And this is a sign that the Hittite king wants to really be on the good side of Ramses. He's sending a beautiful daughter or two, and Ramses marries the daughter. Well, for the first time, unheard of. We are getting kings of Egypt sending their daughters out. They are marrying foreigners. Right? For example, in the Bible, we have in Kings, Kings 1, we got a story. If you remember, Hadad was an Edomite who flees to Egypt. And he becomes in with the Pharaoh. Right? He's one with the Pharaoh. And what we're told is, Hadad became a great favorite of Pharaoh. This is from the Bible. Hadad became a great favorite of Pharaoh, who gave him his own wife's sister in marriage, the sister of the great lady. Now, great lady, of course, is the translation of, in Egyptian, it's Hemetwereth, the great wife, the great wife. So actually, his queen's sister is given to an Edomite to marry. This is a big deal, because she is eventually going to leave the country with her husband. And to send an Egyptian, you know, out of the country was not an easy thing to do. David's son Solomon, he marries an Egyptian princess. So what we have here is a kind of almost reversal of power. It's like everybody wants to have a favorable trade balance. This is a reversal. We're getting Egypt's princesses going out of Egypt, whereas in the old days you got the foreign ones coming in for the king of Egypt to marry. Now, the dynasty ends with Pausanias II, who, a minor king again, a minor king. And what we've had are two dynasties, I think, peacefully coexisting. They exchange family members. They send granite sarcophagus lids north for one. It's not the warring Hatfields and McCoys that a lot of people think. But there's an interesting sidebar to what these, remember the high priests of Amun in the south? There's an interesting sidebar to one thing they did. And I want to tell you, because it's just a wonderful story. When they gathered together the bodies in the tomb of Amenhotep II, and remember Victor Loret, when he was in there, saw three bodies, an old lady, a prince with the sidelock of youth, and a young woman. Well, they're unidentified. They've been robbed. Any jewelry is taken off. Unidentified. Everybody thought they would remain unidentified forever. Maybe not. When these priests preserve these bodies, they may have really been preserving the grandmother of Tutankhamun. And let me tell you why I say that. The older woman, who became known as the Elder Lady around the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, because she was the old lady, but nobody knew who she was. She was called the Elder Lady. She had one arm, her left arm, placed across her chest. That is a sign of royalty, usually royalty. And during the 18th dynasty also, it's a sign of royalty. An Egyptologist looked at this and said, you know, this woman's probably royal. That makes sense. It's a royal tomb. You have all these mummies of kings around. And the question then became, who's missing? Which royal lady, elder lady, would be missing? Now remember, in this tomb was Meneptah, we know that, but also Amenhotep III. And his wife, Queen Tai, she's missing. Now, is it possible that this woman is really Queen Tai, who, if you'll remember, would be the grandmother of Tutankhamun? She's the mother of Akhenaten, who is probably the father of Tutankhamun. Is there any way we can prove that the elder lady is Queen Tai? Well, the answer is probably. In Tutankhamun's tomb was a small coffinette, and it had on it the name of his grandmother, Queen Tai. In the coffinette was a little gold statue, but also a lock of hair of Queen Tai, a keepsake of grandma, right? Because he could keep that. He couldn't talk about his father, the heretic pharaoh, but he could keep grandma's hair. So there's a lock of Queen Tai's hair. Now, hair is very much like fingerprints. It's unique. In a sense, based on the principle, you are what you eat. The chemistry of everybody's hair is different, and it can be analyzed, and we can match hair samples. Is it possible that the hair on the elder lady matches the hair on the lock of hair from Tutankhamun's tomb? Jim Harris, he's actually an orthodontist, not a full-scale Egyptologist, but a very good researcher. Jim Harris did a lot of x-raying of the pharaohs. His specialty was x-raying pharaohs. But he also wondered the same thing I'm suggesting, that the hair might match. And he got permission from the Egyptian government, to take one hair from the elder lady, one hair from the lock from Tutankhamun's tomb and compare. His conclusion was that the hair matched. That spectroanalysis showed that indeed it seems as if this hair matched. So because of these priest kings of the 21st dynasty and their attempt to preserve the mummies of the royal families, we may have located the grandmother of Tutankhamun. But next time we'll pick up the story when Egypt becomes united. No more two kingdoms, one in the north, one in the south. We're going to get unification, but it's going to be by foreigners. I'll see you then.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.